This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3042 for Tuesday, the 31st of March, 2020. Today's show is entitled, The COVID-19 Work From Home Stream, Day Zero. It is the 10th anniversary show of Thajcera, and is about 67 minutes long, and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, a couple of HPR characters decide to spend some of their social distancing time being social.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hey, what's good, everybody? This is Taj. Just wanted to kind of record a little preamble to this episode and the inevitable episodes that are going to come after it. What this essentially is, was a conversation that got started. I don't remember whether it was on the Matrix Room for HPR or Oddcast Planet on IRC. Both are cool places. If you're not there, you should check both of those out. So the other day, we were all talking about the coronavirus self-distancing thing that is going on and how that was kind of socially weird because a lot of us, whether we like to admit it or not, are still social creatures. And CRVS came up with the interesting idea of doing something sort of similar to the HPR New Year's show. What if we just started a stream in the middle of the day that people could just drop into while they were working from home or pretending to work from home? And in either case, I thought about it for a little bit and I thought, hey, that's actually a pretty cool idea. So this is the first of those episodes and hopefully many more to come.
Hey, Taj, can you hear me?
Hey, what's up? Yep. What's going on?
Not much. Anybody show up?
Nope, you're the first person to show up all day. But that's okay. I was really late getting to actually starting.
Yeah, I didn't read about it until like later on. So
my plan is to do it probably the rest of this week and see if anybody actually uses it or not. And if not, no biggie. You know, I'm doing work anyway, so I might as well just sit here and listen to nothing.
Yeah, I got... Yesterday and today, I know I have off, and then I get to go back to work.
I mean, to be honest, I'm a little envious of people who get to go out and go to work. I hate being, like, stuck at home, and we're, like, 3 days in, and I'm ready to just, like, pull my own hair out.
Yeah, but I'm going to a grocery store where people are panicking, and basically I should be wearing a hazmat suit because Lord knows what the people coming in have, so...
Yeah, no, a grocery store is probably not the best place to be. I don't know. I was in a school for the last couple weeks.
Fair enough.
That's pretty terrible at the same time.
Like
we're 99% sure that the only confirmed case of coronavirus that is in our area, my wife got exposed to. So, fun times.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, we have one confirmed case on the Cape, and he lives in the town where the grocery store I work in is. I'm like, I kind of want them to post a picture of the guy who got it, just so I can go. Do I remember seeing this guy in the store or not?
Did this guy cough all over everything I've touched?
Yeah, exactly. And then his wife works for the one of the schools on the Cape.
Yeah, I have a sneaking suspicion that they're gonna realize from this that schools were a major sort of vector for the spread of this stuff.
So the one thing is, though, I don't believe there are any confirmed cases of anybody under the age of like either 15 or 21, something like that.
I think the person that is confirmed here, they haven't said a lot. I think they are younger. I don't think they're older, but they apparently, like, they listed a list of every place they've been, which is basically everywhere to go, including like this regional wrestling tournament in the area. So basically anybody who went to that got exposed.
Oh, fantastic.
You know, good times and all.
Right. Yeah, we were talking the other night because we did family dinner on Saturday. We have my sister-in-law, who is a teacher, my brother-in-law, who also works for the same grocery store company, and my wife, who is a receptionist at a pediatric office, and then me, who works at the grocery store.
Yeah, that sounds like a not good combination.
We're getting it.
I mean, that's pretty much where once it became kind of a thing that everybody, you know, realized this is going to be bigger than it initially was thought to be. We pretty much everybody that works for my program was like, yeah, we're all getting it. Like if we don't already have it and we're carriers, like we're probably getting it.
Right.
Because it's something like if the number of kids that I see on a daily basis, depending on which school I'm at, is close to 500, and so across two different schools, so I see 1,000 kids every week.
There's a good chance that one of those 1,000 may be a carrier.
Yeah, they're all teenagers and they're filthy, so yeah, probably. More than likely, if not, they have something else that I don't want.
Right. The scary thing is, so from my understanding, there's only a limited number of tests, so it seems like some places are just kind of testing for other things and then trying to do process of elimination. Like they'll do a test for flu, and then if they show symptoms of, you know, possible corona, and they don't test positive for flu, they kind of set that as kind of a positive, but it's not a confirmed positive.
That's kind of ridiculous, especially when I'm like hearing from friends who are overseas, like South Korea is basically just testing everybody. They're like, just line up. We're test. If you have the sniffles, we're going to test you. And then we know for a fact. And like, just it kind of makes me angry that America just cannot get its shit together when it comes to this sort of thing.
Right. If South Korea has all of these tests, how come we're like, well, nobody has the test right now?
Because it's not profitable for anybody to have the test right now. And in South Korea, it's free.
At this point, the money should be out there, you know?
Well, I don't know. It's just weird. Like, we just don't think that. I kind of feel like it's this sort of cultural thing to where, you know, I've been around Asian people all my life. Like, there's just sort of their culture is communal. And, like, there would never be, like, even a thought of that costing anything or being a thing that anybody, like everybody would be okay with it. Here it's like, well, I don't have it. Why should I pay for a test for somebody else to take it? It's just this weird, like, I don't get it. I've never gotten it, but I think that's sort of what it is.
But my understanding is once they called state of emergency and whatever the heck Trump called, was a national emergency, doesn't that mean that the money is then out there? So shouldn't the test be out there? I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking about it all wrong.
Yeah, probably, but it seems like all that money is getting handed to a bunch of companies to like keep them solvent because our economy is just like driving off a cliff.
Yeah, there was somebody in IRC who was talking about buying stocks, and that's kind of seems not like a bad idea, you know. While everything is low, try to buy up as much as you can, and then when it comes back, you know, then sell.
Yeah, I've debated doing it. I've always we have a mandatory retirement thing that we have to pay into through the university, and so I don't have a choice on that, so I do put money into that. But as far as like investing in stocks and stuff, I want to choose what companies I invest in. I don't want to go to like, and I know it's dumb, you should go to like a money market account and they just pick the stocks that work the best and stuff. I just ethically I can't do that, but I would love to buy like just a shit ton of Red Hat stock right now and just sit on it and be like, I'm happy now.
Yeah, I mean, investing is one of those things that I always debated on. We have a 401k at my work, 401k at my work, and I never once invested into it, mostly because I spent most of my time at work at my job going, okay, this is the year I finally quit and go do something IT-wise. But I've been saying that for the last 15, 20 years now. So I've yet to put anything in a 401k, but we do have like a mandatory, we have a retirement plan through our union. So I've been kind of just hoping to one day fall into that. But if I had basically enough money right now to to invest anything, I think it's just it's not a bad idea. I mean, everything is going down. It's got to come back up eventually, right?
Here's hoping. I mean, yeah, it will eventually. It's just once all this kind of blows over, it'll bounce back. I mean, it is definitely worth doing. This is actually, the timing works out great for us because this is the first time in my entire adult life, and granted, I'm coming up on 40, that I've had extra money to put into anything. So it's a thing that we're kind of looking at and considering. The one thing I really, 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 really hope that this sort of drives home, at least to most people, is how woefully inadequate our internet infrastructure is in the United States. Hopefully they force people to like do better. Not anything drastic, just do better.
The internet infrastructure, why?
Well, it's like, I know for so like all the schools that I work with, they use Google backend for everything. Google was like totally flaking out yesterday and part of today, to where kids couldn't do their schoolwork because, you know, it just the amount of stuff that was going on, I guess, on Google servers was just like overload because everybody's doing things remote. And then basically, I'd say if I had to guess, 25-30% of the kids at our schools, even though we live in a one of the schools is a very urban setting and the other one is kind of rural. I'd say at least, you know, almost a third don't have internet access at all. And so it's like, well, how do you do this? And when you talk to most of them in the inner city, it's they can't afford it. If it's the rural area, it's like we literally cannot get internet access. Like there's nobody who will run it to us.
That's horrible.
Well, it's like here. We can get internet at my house, but my next door neighbor cannot. And they want to charge him like $15,000 to run a line there. And it's the only high speed internet that he could possibly get because we were right up against it's not a mountain, it's a giant hill. It basically blocks any kind of satellite or anything that from working particularly well. So like nobody down here besides me and the people below me have internet. Everybody else on top doesn't have internet, doesn't have TV, doesn't have cable, doesn't have any of that stuff because the cable company won't run it there because it's not worth it for the, you know, 15, 20 families that live up there.
Well, that's freaking horrible.
Yeah, it sucks. I'm sitting here trying to learn enough Python to teach it, which is kind of hilarious, but that's been my goal for this 3 weeks is become a Python master.
Now, how are you doing that?
Very carefully. No, actually, I'm just kind of bludgeoning my way through stuff. Like, I know a little bit of Python, but basically just enough to, if there's something I want to modify that somebody else wrote, I can figure it out. Or, like, the Umrandom site and my podcast site both run on Nicola, which is, it's Python. So I know enough to, like, go in and fix scripts and stuff, but not enough to actually teach it as a programming language. So I've got a couple books that I've picked up. I've got Klaatu. He has a programming book with a little bit in it on Python, but really it kind of covers what I already knew. And then I'm using Exorcism, which is this like command line programming tutorial thing. And I'm going through a book right now called Learn Python the Hard Way, which is sort of freely available. And it's pretty good. It's like just type things until you get it.
That sounds cool.
It is. It's nice to have like dedicated time to do it. Before it was the thing was, hey, learn this before this summer because you're going to need to teach it this summer. But we're not going to give you any time to do it. At least now I have a couple weeks to sit down and to get up to speed.
Yeah, my thing is I can never, like, I always wanted to learn a programming language, but at the same time, the process, I think, of getting my mind around a programming language would be I'd have to have an end goal. Like, I want to program, make a program to do this, or some sort of problem I have to solve to actually get myself to do it, you know? Like, I learned Bash because I wanted to set up that script to do the editing for my the podcast editing, the audio editing.
Yeah, I think kind of that's, I learned Bash just from copying Bash scripts. I mean, that's really what it was. I would find something that did kind of what I wanted, and I just smashed on it until it did something. But really, I think where I started to learn programming as like a thing was Emacs and Emacs Lisp, just being able to go in and write little programs to do what I want with a key combination. That got me into like Scheme and Lisp and Racket and all those, which I use all the time and I love, but they're very different ideas to sort of the way Python does it. Like the basics are kind of the same, but you know, I'm used to sort of functional programming. That's not what this is at all. Exorcism is kind of cool because it gives you little tasks to do. That's basically all it is. It's like, hey, do this task, and then it gives you a file that is a bunch of tests. And it's like, if your program can pass these tests, then you pass. Like, if it doesn't, then you just need to keep working on it until it passed that test. So it is sort of like problem based, but it isn't a problem that you want to solve. It's a problem they're giving you.
Have you heard of, what was it, Grasshopper? I'm not sure if Grasshopper teaches probably Java, but let me take a
look. Huh. No, I've never even heard of it.
Yeah, it's an Android app. It kind of puts it kind of like a game style.
Hmm. It shows JavaScript. I don't know if it does anything else. Yeah, it looks like it's JavaScript, basically, with some HTML and CSS in it, which JavaScript, it's equally nice. My thing is the state wants to standardize on Python, which is why I have to learn it. I can't just teach coding with whatever language I know. They are like, hey, create this curriculum with Python because that's what we want.
Well, at least Python is very useful.
Yeah, I think, well, the driving force behind this was the politicians in the state decided to add a computer science degree or computer science classes to every high school. So every high school in Indiana has to have computer science starting next year. They didn't worry about like teachers actually being licensed to teach that or anything. So they pushed it through without thinking about it because apparently a lot of businesses were saying, this is what we need. We need coding skills. We need Python specifically, because apparently that's just a big thing here. And so that's where it's coming from. But now people like me are stuck making it work after them not being prepared for it.
There's a lot of jobs that require Python in your area?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know how many of them are in my area. But Indiana is trying, probably like most states, to brand itself as like the Silicon Valley of the Midwest, which it will never be. But I'm like, that's probably Chicago. That makes a whole lot more sense. But they've been pushing sort of the whole computer science, technology, engineering, sort of STEM stuff really hard for the high school kids, because it's a lot of the manufacturing that was here is gone. And so they're trying to find something to replace that. And they're thinking that some of these more tech oriented jobs will fill in here, which it may. I don't know, but I'm not very confident about it. I think they're just training kids to leave at this point. Like, we're going to give you the skills to go somewhere else where they need you.
Well, I don't live in that area, but that might not be a bad thing. At least they might be able to get internet.
Hey, oh, bringing it back. Yeah, that just once again proving my point. Like, they can't get their stuff together enough to make sure everybody has internet, but yet they will. They'll push this as like the next big thing. There's this weird sort of like, I live in southern Indiana, which is very different than northern Indiana, which is very different than central Indiana. And central Indiana is where all the politics happens. And people in the south are very different than the people in the center. So a lot of times the lawmaking doesn't really reflect what happens down here. And I'm told the same thing happens up north, that they don't really fit in with what the center is doing. And so it's just exceedingly different between the different places. Like, I've always felt like I fit closer into Kentucky because, you know, I can literally walk like 5 minutes and look across the river and see Kentucky from my house. That our culture is much more Kentucky than it is northern Indiana, which is very, very different. Like, one of the things I was trying to get a kid to understand the other day, because he comes from a family that are farmers, and I was like, okay, explain to me when you see a farmer, what does it look like? And they're like, you know, somebody in jeans, probably a flannel shirt, you know, hat on a tractor and stuff like that. I was like, yeah, that's totally southern Indiana farmers. When I meet with farmers who are from the north of the state, they come in wearing business suits. Like, it's big business up there, and it's not like that down here. So it's a very different sort of cultural difference between the two.
A farmer in a business suit?
Oh, yeah. Big ag is huge here. There's a lot of money to be made selling lots of corn to high fructose corn syrup plants.
Well, are they farmers or just the guys who own the farm?
A lot of times what my understanding, and this is just me being around, a lot of times people will own the land that farms are on, and then they rent that to farmers, and the farmers actually do the work and they pay rent, and then they get a percentage of the profits of whatever it is. So a lot of the farm owners tend to not be farmers themselves. They're just people who own the sort of capital to make it happen.
So they're not really farmers. They're just, they own some land.
Yeah, but they call themselves farmers, which is kind of funny. That's one of the reasons in the last couple of years I've gotten into like growing food and stuff is because I don't know. It's one of those things where I grew up like around people that did it. Like my family always had a big, huge plot of land, and we always grew a bunch of food, and we ate canned food, you know, that we grew. And then when I got old enough to do it myself, I just kind of like whatever. And now I'm kind of getting back into it because it's, I don't know. I enjoy it. I think it's fun.
Now, didn't you set something up where like, you had like Raspberry Pis or wasn't Raspberry Pis, was it? But single board computers basically monitoring the soil and stuff.
Yeah, I did set that up. I wound up for that bed that I did, I wound up taking it out because it was less than useful, to be completely honest. I thought it was going to save me some work, but it actually didn't, because a lot of the time I spent more time dialing that in to get it right than it was worth to just like go out and check and make sure if everything needs to be watered. It was just easier to do the work than it was to the thought experiment of actually making it run. I was running it off of a chipboard, like the old pocket chip, but the actual like computer that came out of that. But then one of the projects I got involved in was these controlled agriculture systems where you basically create an environment inside a container and then you grow inside that. Now that is my jam right now, and I'm playing with that a lot, but that's all indoor stuff. That's growing stuff during the winter, doing that because I can actually grow stuff inside, which is nice.
You have space to grow stuff inside?
Well, I have my basement, which is not huge, but like the grow system I have now that's downstairs is like 3 foot by 3 foot by 3 foot. It's basically a 3 foot cube, and I can grow enough just like basically greens and some herbs and stuff to where we could have stuff during the year, even during the winter. I couldn't grow anything like tomatoes or anything, but usually we'll grow tomatoes and we'll can those, and we have those through the year. So it's kind of nice between freezing and canning and having this. I can usually keep fresh food that we made available all the time.
Now, do you have a root cellar or just like a regular cellar?
It's just a regular basement. Like it's basically storage / MySpace. It's what it is. So I have like, we have a little gym in the basement that has like a practice floor for martial arts and all our workout equipment. Then we have the studio, which is the little room that I'm in, the washer and dryer. And then the rest of it is storage / whatever projects I stuff down here, which includes that box.
See, that sounds like something I would come up with. And then my wife goes, really? You're going to stick a giant thing of dirt down in our basement?
See, that's the thing. There's no dirt involved in mine. It's all hydroponic.
I'm not sure if that would be any better. Dirt you can move. The water, if it breaks, would be a little bit bigger of a mess.
Well, our basement floods like once a year anyways. So, and actually I have it to where if it does, it actually, there's drainage troughs all along our basement to where if something does go wrong, all the water just dumps into there, which is kind of bad because it's like got chemicals in it and it probably shouldn't be put into the water supply, but you know, it is what it is. I'm probably a bad person. I should fix that.
Nah, I'm sure it's fine.
Trust me, I actually live where I grew up, which is kind of interesting to come back. I've seen a lot worse things be dumped into the water supply here. So, you know.
Now, was it just hydroponic? Like going crazy and trying like the aquaponics or something? No fish?
I would love to do aquaponics, but it takes, it just takes so much more space. This is easy at this point to do. So, it's what I'm going with. I don't actually like hydroponics that much as far as like the method, because pretty much to do it, you have to use chemical fertilizers. And while there's nothing wrong with that, it's the whole getting rid of it is a problem. During the summer, it's easy to get rid of because I can just dump it on our plants and our plants will take up the extra nutrients. And by the time it filters through the beds, it's clean water again. But, you know, during the winter, you just wind up storing that water because you can't really just get rid of it. I would really like to try aeroponics, but that is just not something I've gotten around to playing with.
Now, what is aeroponics?
Basically taking hydroponic solution and atomizing it into basically fog. And then you can use a lot less water and a lot less nutrients, but you just keep the roots submerged in this fog of nutrients. And supposedly it is exceedingly efficient to do it that way. It's just getting it set up and making sure that it runs and all that stuff. Probably once I have time, which I guess right now would be the perfect time to start playing with it, is to try to set that up. It's one of the things I think NASA actually kind of came up with it because they thought, hey, this is the best way to do it in space because you don't need a whole lot of water.
I think setting up something where that's just creating the fog for all of it would be the hardest part, I think.
They have these little ultrasonic atomizers to where my understanding is they're just kind of PWM, and then you figure out what frequency it needs to be to atomize the water, and you just put it inside the water and it creates the fog. It's really easy. It's just me figuring out how to wire that into the system and how to create, because right now everything is basically kind of in mason jars, and that's how the water gets held. I don't know if that would work, and being able to fit all the wires to do all that into it while growing the plants, I'd have to think of a new container kind of idea to do it.
So do you just have a bunch of plants basically sitting in mason jars underneath the grow light?
Yes, except for the grow light, I can change the frequency of light, the intensity of light, the duration of light. I can control to a certain extent the humidity inside the chamber. I can monitor the CO2 levels, and when that gets too low or too high, purge the air system to pull in fresh air. Monitor temperature, humidity, be able to change those as I need to. So there's lots of variables. And the idea is once you kind of figure out what the right variables are for a certain kind of plant, put plant in machine, turn on program, it grows food. Very little interaction between the places.
Now, is there, judging by what you were saying and the amount of extra work there is than my last explanation, so you basically have like a little grow tent with the lighting across it, and then it's set up to ventilate and whatnot?
Yeah, it's actually a hard box at this point. It's just made out of plywood, to be completely honest, and then it's lined with this foil insulation stuff. The sensors kind of go into the box on the inside, the lighting goes into the box, and there's fan ports on the outside with little levers that will pull open the doors for the fan ports to where it will keep it fairly contained until you activate opening those doors. And then you can do the air exchange in and out. And then there's temperature inside to where if it's getting too hot, I can open up and pull in colder air because it's in the basement. It's usually colder. And that's usually the way it has to do. It tends to get hotter in there than it does cooler. And that, for the most part, because we have dehumidifiers down here, that also kind of controls the humidity. I haven't had to like write rules for the humidity because it kind of automatically stays exactly where it's at. But I do all this and control it all with a right now an Arduino that's just running all the sensors and running all those machines and the lights and all that.
Cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wish I had more time to play with it, but it serves its purpose for right now.
Yeah, I mostly just fail at a garden in my backyard.
I'm getting to where I, you know, when I first got into this, I was like, you know, I got to make this as technologically efficient as I can because I don't have time and I don't have the knowledge. So I just want like the math to save me on this. If I know what the right percentage of water in the soil is, then I can make that happen with a Arduino. And the more I get into it, the more I'm just like, you know what, just throw some seeds in the dirt and, you know, it, most of the time it'll happen. You know, you just got to kind of be careful and hanging out with people that know more about it and just sort of like learning like, oh, if if the leaves are yellow on the edges, that's what this means. And it's kind of like there's an art to it that I just completely was ignoring. I just wanted the outcome without actually learning anything, which is never a good recipe for success. So the more I do, like this year, I'm planning more just by throwing seeds out and saying, hey, we're gonna see what happens.
Yeah, we basically just buy some baby plants, plant them in the garden, and water them. That's pretty much about it.
For me, that's tends to do fairly well. I haven't had a lot of, I do a lot of prep work. That's been my big thing up to this point, is sort of getting the beds ready and making sure all that is happening. I've been this year, I'm experimenting with some new kinds of, like, trying to grow, like doing some permaculture stuff, just because I can. I have the resources to do it sort of automatically as a waste product here. So we have horses, so we have manure, and we have like spent hay that they don't eat. So there's a lot of kind of permaculture-y things I can do with that. So we're going to try it and see what happens.
Yeah, my mother did something along those lines where she would take like the eggshells and whatnot and crush them up into things. I swear, we had a plant that we had like my mother take care of while we were on our honeymoon, which was 10 years ago. And she did something to the soil and like replanted the thing and blah, blah, blah. And that thing lasted like for another 5 years with like no major effort on our part afterwards. And she did the same thing. She gave us this this like chive plant, and my wife came up with this brilliant idea of putting it inside of a cutout milk jug. And that thing has been sitting on my deck for since probably before we bought this house. Well, probably about since we bought this house. So it's been about 3 years, and I swear you could probably cut chives off the thing right now.
Nice.
We don't even water the thing. I mean, it's just out there.
I went to a talk by this guy that he's a farmer, and they just happened to have him come to the university and give a talk. And he was just sort of like, you know, most of the time we're getting in our own way because nature has figured out the perfect way of dropping a thing in the ground and it just sort of doing its own thing. Most of the time plants will do what they're going to do regardless. And it's us getting in the way that tends to mess up the plans, or we're trying to get something to do something it was never meant to do. And that's why you have problems. And so it kind of changed my perspective on it to just like, just let it grow and see what happens. I mean, I'll do little things that I know work, or, you know, I have a subset of plants that I'll just try something and see if it's any better than what I was doing before. But most of the time it's either a hindrance or it didn't make any appreciable difference.
With me, I think I just need to come up with some better ideas of things to try besides just, I mean, we really don't, I mean, we have the same basic soil. We, you know, we move around on the garden where things are. We turn the soil. We were going to try something where I have a friend who raises turkeys, and like maybe trying some like turkey poop in there, but I'm not sure if that would mess it up or not. And to be honest, I'm not looking forward to transporting turkey poop, but, yeah, we got to come up with something else other than just stick it in the ground and hope for the best. A little bit of effort on it.
Small amounts of effort are important.
Right. You know, to be honest, this past summer, I think it was like, oh, crap, we forgot to even water it.
I've been there. The thing with, I don't know if turkey droppings are like chicken droppings, but if you put the droppings like directly on the plants, it burns them. So you have to kind of like pre-compost it, which doesn't take a long time. So we usually have compost going, so you can just sort of throw it in there and it'll like supercharge your compost pile. And then it sort of like tames down, I think, the amount of nitrogen that's in it. But then after that, like whatever that compost is fantastic. It's like literally supercharged. It's kind of amazing.
That's, I think my wife heard something about that to begin with, and then I brought, so I told her that I knew somebody who raises turkeys. I don't think they have any chickens. I mean, it's just turkeys. They come to, I work in a grocery store. I work in the produce department of the grocery store, and one of the ways that they're that the company is trying to cut down on waste or better help the neighborhood type of a deal was some local farms will come in and take all of like the excess dead leaves of stuff, and they'll give them to the farm, and then the farm will use them for their, you know, turkeys, chickens, whatever. So I was talking with them about that, and they said, yeah, they actually put some of the stuff together, and I'm not sure if they sell it or not, but she knew all about it and knew all about how to mix the stuff up right. I think we didn't wind up doing it last year for whatever reason, whether we just didn't get the stuff in time or we didn't, you know, like you said, it's one of those things that's going to take a lot of effort to get it into the ground and to get it like we don't have a compost pile, so it'd be basically get it into the ground and get it separated enough. It might have to sit for a year or so before we can actually start using it for so it's fully composted. Again, this was probably around this time last year that I was talking to him about it, so half the stuff is gone from my brain now.
Yeah, usually for compost, we kind of keep two piles going. One is usually leaves and stuff. Like during the summer, I will take grass clippings that kind of pile up. We got one spot that just, no matter how much you do, grass clippings just kind of clump up and kill everything underneath them. So I usually, every time I mow the grass, I have to rake that up and move it. So I do that and I throw that in the compost bin. And then in the fall, I usually, whatever leaves are around, I use we've got a leaf blower that is also a leaf vacuum. And so it just sort of like sucks them up and mulches it. And it's a thing I'm doing anyways. Like I can't just leave all the leaves on the ground because it would literally mat and kill everything. So I do that. That goes in the compost pile. The only other things we put in the compost pile are coffee grounds that we have every day. So we put that in there, and that, the carbon is sort of the other stuff, and the nitrogen is the coffee grounds. And then usually once a year, we'll put some manure in there just because we've got it. It's laying around. We got to muck it out anyways. And then in 6 months, that's compost is ready to go. Then we keep another compost pile that is literally just kitchen scraps that we throw in there from whatever we're eating. And then, you know, I'll usually, just to kind of keep it from stinking and looking bad, take a handful of leaves or something and throw it on top. And, that one takes a little longer. Usually, you'll flip it every so often just because that's what you do. And then about a year I've got compost, but we have so much of it that I'm usually asking around trying to find people to give it to. Cause I'm like, hey, who needs some compost? I got some.
Yeah. At my old house, we had enough room. We had, basically a large amount of conservation land between, my house, well, my property line and like the next house. There was a whole lot of woods through there, trees. There was even like a little stream that ran through it. And now in the place I'm living now, the house is a little bit nicer. But when it comes to the property, we're basically like house on top of house on top of house. So I have like a decent yard and stuff, but it's not big enough really. Unless I may be able to set up a little composting area, but I mean, it wouldn't be able to hold a whole lot. Not like I used to have. Well, I didn't even really compost beforehand, but I had a large area where I basically just threw a bunch of leaves and everything else, grass clippings, whatever I felt like.
Yeah, I know the rule of thumb kind of for composting is that you need, basically kind of like my grow center, you need a 3-foot cube. And that's so you have enough space on the interior to enough insulation around that space to get the temperatures you need for the bacteria to grow. Anything less than that, you're just kind of setting things out there waiting for it to rot. You need sort of that thermal mass to make it inviting enough for the bacteria to do their job and do it quicker. So that's usually like the rule of thumb. And most of the big like plastic compost containers you can buy, that's what they are. They're 3 foot by 3 foot by 3 foot, because that's kind of the magic number.
That makes sense.
I didn't know today would turn into growing with Taj.
Right?
Ken is cursing me because he's like, this could have been a show.
Are you not recording?
Oh, I am actually. So it is a show. There you go. Congratulations, Ken.
Hey, there you go.
I had thought about doing like a HBR series on like how to grow things if you can't grow anything and see if I could make a bunch of people grow some plants just for my own amusement.
Yeah, that'd probably be great.
Mayhaps, mayhaps.
I still think you need to unleash all the old book clubs.
So we have movement on that front. Pokey was finally able to get the hardware he needed to pull the hard drive out of the freezer and try to spin it up, and it is dead. So we're probably going to continue with what we have, but there are going to be gaps where we've just lost episodes. It's going to be interesting how we navigate that, but we're trying to figure that out now.
At this point, I think enough time has passed, then we're just listening to it too, because we want to listen to people's reviews on things. Obviously, we can't, no one else can participate. So, I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah. My big thing through all this is, we've got several episodes with 50 on there that it's just like, there's 50 out there that people haven't heard. And I definitely want to get it out so people hear it. But actually, Lost in Bronx is going to be on the next E-Random. And he's gone and done the show notes for it. And he's going to berate us about how we should, A, get those out, and B, start again. So that's probably on the horizon in the future.
Now, what were the thoughts about starting it again? I know the big problem was the availability of books, because the site you guys went to, which is escaping my mind at the moment, changed their whole model to more of a pay model or a subscribe model. So what were the thoughts about where to get books?
Well, Podio Books doesn't exist, but it's turned into Scribble, which is this new service. And the problem with that is they've mixed the kind of free culture books up with paid books. And so it's a little more difficult to know what is free culture, what's not, and what's freely available. I mean, you can get things for free, but is it like technically free as in freedom instead of free as in cost? That was the biggest place that we got things. I think there are plenty of places to continue to get things. Like LibriVox has tons of public domain stuff. Like, we could literally just do classic books for the rest of time and never run out of things. I think people are less interested in some of the older stuff, but like Lost in Bronx still publishes books. I know of a couple books I've read in the last year or two that are sort of free culture books. It's like, there's just not a centralized place anymore. Like, we can still do it. It's just not as convenient as it once was. And so I think that's, A, we've just been behind. We haven't published what we already have, so nobody's gone out and looked for it. And B, having lost that centralized spot has been difficult to find new things.
Well, if you ever start up again, let me know. I mean, I tried following along several times, and I know there was like once or twice where I went on Mumble on like the wrong days for some reason. But I mean, I always enjoyed the audiobook club.
Yeah, I enjoyed doing it. Like, it was fun. It was nice to have an excuse to like read a book. Like, as bad as that sounds, like, I'm constantly reading. I'm just not reading anything that I want to read. It's always like research or things like that. So I liked having the excuse of like reading fiction that I enjoyed. I would love to do it again. I think the idea is, if we get out what we have, and we've kind of tossed around the idea of publishing once a month, just in case people do want to read the book before they hear the review of it, which could be, that's part of the problem, because like the last one we published talked about a book. We've lost that episode. So now we have to somehow go back and add on a thing saying, okay, for this episode, now we're skipping to this book instead, because we lost the episode that had that, and sort of like finding our way through and hiccuping and re-recording a part to stick on it to make that happen, to where to everybody else it should seem seamless, like there shouldn't be a huge thing. But for us, it's a little more work on the back end to make that happen. But once all those get out, then saying, okay, do we want to do this? Do we want to continue to do it? Or, you know, just hand it over to the community and see who else wants to do it. It may not be us three that we sort of took it over, I think, more than anything. But do we put it out there and let other people do it? And we can do it if we want or not. But I feel like as stewards of the audiobook club, we pretty much screwed up big time with this, so it's maybe worth seeing if anybody else wants to handle it.
Well, throw it on the mailing list, see if you get any bites.
May do.
Is it, my big thing is I like audiobooks, but I've never been a good judge of what to pick up for an audiobook, and I don't want to just kind of randomly start grabbing at stuff and hoping for the best, because then that cuts into my podcast listening time.
Yeah, that's been sort of an issue for me is, you know, I will find a thing that I want to read, and I just, podcasts are part of my routine. And so I have to bump those out, which sets off my routine, and I like routines. And so having a reason to do it really helped me focus on like, read this. And we've been kind of doing that like as friends, like Pokey recommended a book to me that I'm doing right now and going through. And it's nice to kind of have him to bounce it off of. But it's not something we would do in public because it's not free culture, and it's kind of a little bit politically charged. So I wouldn't put it out there for like the whole community to read. But it's having that little a bit of accountability really helps me get through stuff.
My thing is, I used to have an hour commute back and forth to work. So that was 2 hours of listening. So I'm now down to roughly about 20 minutes a day of, you know, back and forth listening. So maybe about 40 minutes a day of listening. So it's cut way back. I mean, I have a hard time when I'm at home with the kids here, being able to listen to podcasts and stuff. But I do enjoy audiobooks. I mean, it's especially for if you have like a long commute or a long drive, like audiobooks are great for that. They just kind of suck you out of, you know, obviously my eyes are still on the road, but my mind is, you know, in this book. Podcasts kind of do that depending on who you're listening to, but, you know, it's not as much as a book.
Yeah, for sure. I get a lot more time to do books during the summer when I spend, you know, a good portion of my weekend on the back of a tractor, like mowing grass or doing something. So that's definitely my prime time for getting stuff done. Podcasts are just hard because everybody keeps coming out with podcasts and they keep being good. So it's hard for me to whittle down. Like I've gone through literally in the last year, like 3 purges of just like getting rid of shows that I don't listen to anymore. And pretty much almost everything I listen to, with a few exceptions, are like HPR adjacent podcasts. And there's so many of us now at this point that I don't really have time for anything else.
Yeah, I've whittled mine down to like Tilts, Mincast, random HPRs that I find interesting, Linux for the Rest of Us, the Mini PC Show. Yep, I think that's really about it.
I think I listen to all of those except for Tilts. And I listened to Tilts for years. I just finally gave it up. So what are you printing in the background? Because I hear your printer running.
Oh, so my kids have... This is like the long way around this. My kids have Amazon Fire tablets. So on there, they found something called Zebra Gamer, which is a guy who sits down and plays through like Luigi's Mansion, Mario Party, Mario Maker and stuff. And both of them have gotten basically just addicted to this. So my son somehow all of a sudden thinks that the Goombas, those little mushroom little things, are the coolest things ever. So they know that I've been 3D printing stuff lately. So they asked if I could print them one. So I'm printing a Goomba for my son, Goomba for my son, and Princess Peach for my daughter.
Nice.
Yeah, these past couple of days have just been like nothing but Mario stuff. I have a Wii that we bought a long time ago. And we bought Mario for it. My wife and I, we bought it, and then we like had children, and then the thing just never got used. And so now I busted the thing out, and my son's been going crazy about playing Super Mario on the Wii.
Nice. I've never been a gamer, but that is one video game, like any Mario, I can sit down and at least enjoy for a little bit. they're such a low barrier to entry. Like my video gaming, besides something that simple, is NetHack. At the low end, or like my undying love for Elite Dangerous. And other than those two games, I don't really have a lot of time to do anything else.
Hello.
Hey, hello. It's the guy whose idea this was.
Yeah, I was stuck in a Skype call with a bunch of people. Turns out I finished my PhD today. So we had like a bunch of people just drinking and Skyping.
Congratulations.
Yeah, totally. Congrats. That is no small feat, and I cannot wait until the day that I get to say the same thing.
It was exhausting.
Yep, it is.
So, what's up around here? I heard something about Mario. My colleagues got me a Raspberry Pi 3, which is actually a pretty good idea, because I had not gotten one like a week ago. I was looking at the Raspberry Pi website to go like, I think I should get a Raspberry Pi. Nah, I should probably not buy anything before. And here it is.
I would say anytime the question is, should I buy a Raspberry Pi? The answer is yes. Just go ahead and do it.
My thing is, though, with the Raspberry Pi 4, it seems... I don't know, with the whole like heatsink thing and everything else, and the fact that they really haven't come up with any new images for it, it almost seems like you're better off getting like a Raspberry Pi 3.
I'm thinking of switching my OpenBSD server from my NUC into a Raspberry Pi 3. I just don't want to have fans all the time in my bedroom.
I can, the only use case that I have used the Raspberry Pi 4 for, and it's the 4 gigabyte model, like the top of the line, is last year I set up a security system with cameras and stuff around the house, and I used a Raspberry Pi 3, and same cameras, same everything, and it's worked like a champ. Did the same thing at my parents' house just because it was, you know, fairly new. This was only a month or two ago. My parents bought the Raspberry Pi 4 with the more gigabytes because more is better, which typically is true. And we set it up. They have had more problems with theirs than I had ever seen with mine. So I don't know. Maybe it's just not worked out right, or like you said, the software is not there, but it's not running as well as my Raspberry Pi 3. So I was going to get one just to have one, but I kind of held off. I have also contemplated moving my entire server, which is this, you know, very old dual core x86 rig, because I think most of the things that I run on it, I can get Docker containers that'll run on Raspberry Pi, and it's about the same processing power. So it would actually run faster if I moved over to Raspberry Pi, but I'm waiting to sort of let it settle out a little bit.
Yeah, this is a Raspberry Pi 3B. I'm just wondering how I'm going to get OpenBSD to run in it. I'm not sure if OpenBSD actually runs in it. I might have to try NetBSD. So that's going to be fun.
Where is Claudio when I need to ask a BSD question? Like, where are you at, right, bro?
Podcast planet, probably.
Actually, he is. I was just looking and he is in there. I should be like, yo, Slacker, get on here.
Or Mastodon.
Yeah, I think I saw him there just like a minute ago.
Does anybody else besides Claudio post to Mastodon?
I do all the time. Well, I won't say all the time. I'm on Mastodon all the time. I don't post as often as I probably should. But I use Mastodon is my number one go-to social media. It's where I talk to most people. Matrix has moved in on that a little bit, but Mastodon's where it's at.
Yeah, I'm a bit of an antisocial, but I'm still there. So CRBS at mastodon.social.
Every time I go, I haven't seen anything from you in a long time, and I'm pretty sure I'm following you. But I see that like, every time I go on there, it's a giant thing of like every couple of hours from Claudio.
Claudio does post nonstop. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm looking at OpenBSD's ARM64 port, and it has a bunch of things, but it doesn't list Raspberry Pi 3 will apparently run OpenBSD.
Okay, I guess that's what I'm going to try now. Well, not right now.
Do you only have one Raspberry Pi?
Just the one.
Oh, Taj, do you only have one?
No. I've got lots. No, all of my security cameras are Raspberry Pi Zeros, and then they all talk to a Raspberry Pi 3. And then I have, let me count the mini Raspberry Pis. Then I have Octoprint on a Pi on my printer. And then I have basically the same kind of setup on my CNC, but it's not OctoPi. It's like a CNC version of it. What else? There's something else that runs on a Raspberry Pi around here. And then I have like a box of them. Some of the older ones. Oh, I have an old emulator that's connected. That's like the first gen Raspberry Pi connected to the TV upstairs, and then various other single board computers.
Wait, you have a CNC?
I do, actually.
Why?
Because I make things, and I could. That was basically the reason why. My dad was a machinist for years, and so he, after he sort of left working for other people, he started his own business, and then he did that until he retired, and then he went back to work for somebody else where he learned how to use all these CNC machines and stuff. sort of the more modern tech. And so he got really into that. And then when he retired from that, he didn't have access to the machines anymore. And he was really kind of heartbroken because he would make like these little art projects, or he would, you know, mill out little hardware pieces he needed for this and that. And so because we always bond over like building stuff. That's, you know, because we're men, that's what we do. This was right when I was into building 3D printers a lot and into that technology, and MPCNC came out, and I was like, let's build one of these. So we have a giant 4-foot by 4-foot CNC.
That's fascinating. How come there's no, is there an HBR episode on that?
There's not. See, why y'all call me out on the stream about not doing HBRs? Come on, guys.
I'm just saying that sounds like it's obvious.
Well, stop doing such cool things, and we'll stop asking you to tell us about it.
I mean, if you were like knitting, well, actually knitting, I mean, that doesn't sound that uninteresting.
No, knitting's actually fascinating. I enjoy the little bit of it I know how to do. But yeah, Ken is like throwing a shoe at his MP3 player right now, like, make more shows.
Does this count?
It will, because I'm publishing it.
Ah, I see.
We talked about growing plants earlier, and I had said that I had mulled over like making an HPR about that, and Honky was like, yeah, you just did. I was like, oh yeah, good call.
Yeah, I think I've finally slowed down my single board computer obsession just for a little while.
I got a bunch of them to test for different things. So I would get one that I thought would be really good at a use case, and then it wound up not being good at it, or it didn't. I used it. So I just wound up with a bunch of them, and they were so cheap for a while. You could just buy tons of them. I mean, it's nowhere near as bad as my Arduino habit. Like, I literally have just boxes of Arduinos laying around.
I think you should probably be able to run some of those cameras with Arduino.
Yeah, you could create, you could create a camera with the Arduino. The problem is the networking. And some of the newer Arduinos are like an ESP32 you could do Wi-Fi with. But at the time, they didn't have that built in. So it was kind of you can do it. It's just more trouble than it's worth. When doing that with a Raspberry Pi Zero, especially the Zero W, you've got the built-in Wi-Fi. You can just put the cameras wherever, and they just work. You don't have to worry about running any cables or anything like that.
Yeah, just the full Pi sounded a little bit like an overkill. But yeah, I get your point.
Oh, it is totally overkill. Thankfully, they're really cheap. it's overkill I'm willing to do.
Well, at some point they were giving them on a magazine, wasn't it? At some point.
Yeah, I think I forget who it was. It was one of the magazines was giving away Raspberry Pi. I got really lucky because I don't live anywhere near a Micro Center, which you know, the closest one's like 2 hours away. But usually I could time it to where they would have sales where you could just get like a Raspberry Pi Zero for like $5 a piece and just go buy a handful of them and walk out, and then I'd have enough to do whatever project I wanted to do.
Yeah, I never really had anything to actually do with them until I decided to replace this NUC with it. And I guess I said it loud enough so that my colleagues got me one.
Nice.
Right?
I mean, I just need some colleagues that most of the stuff I talk about, my colleagues just roll their eyes and are like, I don't know what he's talking about.
So it's actually interesting. So I had there was like these three nerdy projects I was talking about. So one of them was just I have this NUC acting as a server in my bedroom. So I wanted to switch it to Raspberry Pi because fans. And the other one was there's this woman that posted a rotary phone, a rotary cell phone. And I was like, that sounds amazing. And the other one was the Ben Eater's 8-bit breadboard computer. So I was like, and of course I talk about these things endlessly, and then they ended up settling on the Raspberry Pi because not only was the 8-bit computer much more expensive because you had to buy all the parts, but also because it wouldn't get here in time. Unless you bought all the parts separately, just locally, which would take like a while to track them down.
Yeah, I would love to be able to find parts for anything locally. I wind up AliExpress as my friend because it's the only place I can get half the things I want.
Yeah, I mean, there's some online electronic stores that you can buy parts, I guess.
I'm pretty much just Amazon. I think I used AliExpress like once. Actually, I think my wife used it. She bought this, which one's this? The Orange Pi R1. It's the one that has two NICs on it.
Yeah, I know that was really popular when it came out.
Yeah, but we need to try to get some sort of like a tiny firewall set up with it. I know the one downside to it is kind of like with the Raspberry Pi, it's not gigabit, it's only probably about 100.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good. My router has been not acting super great lately. I think I might have to replace it in the not so distant future.
Well, how is it acting? Well, so you can always try to look and see whether you can reflash the firmware on it.
Ooh, that sounds painful.
It's really not that hard. And once you get some of these other firmwares on there, then, I mean, it makes a lot of the routers a lot more usable. It opens up so many different things that you can do with these things.
Sounds like something I can do if I have an extra router.
Well, if you're looking to throw that one away, then you will have an extra router.
That is a very good point. But only after I actually think of throwing this one away and getting a replacement can I do that.
That's true. You would have to be very brave to just hope that works or fixes the problem.
Yeah, it's like when I switched to Linux, I was trying to dual boot install Ubuntu on my machine. Turns out the dual part of the dual boot didn't go so well. And I was like, well, I guess now I'm here.
That's one way to do it.
Sorry, just filling out show notes.
What about tags?
Oh, trust me, I'm tagging this. I'm tagging all the things. I have such a list of tags that Dave Morris is probably going to get a plane, even with the coronavirus. He's going to get on a plane, come across the ocean, and smack me for how much work I'm going to give him when I give him this list of tags that I'm working on.
Links. Don't forget lots and lots of links.
Yes.
Oh, and put a bunch of weird formatting.
Yeah, I'm really bad at the formatting because whenever I do something, my brain defaults to org mode, and then I have to just go back and change it to Markdown. So usually it winds up being some weird hybrid of the two because I'm not very thorough. I'm sure he's not going to be pleased with that.
Yeah, I used to use Emacs, and I tried org mode for a while, and it was kind of interesting, but I never really caught the use there.
Emacs is my second brain. Like, between org mode and just all the stuff I do, especially like research stuff and writing papers, if you took Emacs away from me, it would be like starting over with stone tablets and chisels. My brain is just so integrated in the way it works that I don't think I could. It would be like starting all over.
I don't know. I had a huge configuration file. It took like minutes to, maybe not minutes, but maybe a good minute, maybe two even, to start Emacs. And then I started just using Vim to edit a file or two every now and again when I wanted to do a quick in and out. Otherwise, I tried to keep Emacs rolling all the time. And at some point, I was like, well, I might as well just start using Vim all the time.
I was going to say, that's your problem. You closed Emacs. You never close Emacs. You just leave it running forever because that is the operating system.
Yeah, but like you boot your computer and then you don't want to boot it again after that.
That is, depending on how much stuff you have installed, that is a huge downside. It can take, and the way that your .emacs file is written, there are ways to speed it up, but if you're just throwing things in there, it just takes forever.
Yeah, I can offer no explanation to how that was written at the time. I don't even remember what was in there. I just remember it was a ton.
There's so many good things. That's the problem.
So I'm just going to throw out Nano for the win.
Look, I'm not going to lie. Nano is dope. And I will open Nano before I open Vim. like, so I'm on the nano train. I can get down with that hype.
I just can't. Every time I open nano, I go like, how do I quit this?
To nano?
Yeah, but you can get you at the bottom.
Yes, but I am not used to actually looking for hints in my screen. I'm used to my screen being a huge canvas of blackness, and ignore anything that is in there. That's just clutter.
So my first experience with command line text editors was, I believe I was trying to install TinyCorn Linux, and one of them was the just explanation I had to change a like config file in there. And it says you can open up either Vim or Nano. And so I tried Vim, and it just, I couldn't do anything. I didn't know how to even get a cursor on the screen or anything to be able to edit anything. I couldn't get out of it. So I wound up shutting the whole thing down. I said, the other way is Nano. So I opened up Nano. It was real easy. I can move cursor down to what I needed to change. And like Taj said, to tell me how to exit things, to save and exit, it's right there at the bottom of the screen. It was simple. It was easy. I made my changes and was out and was happy.
Yeah, but I think my first interaction with Vim was probably with VIPW. That was not fun. But I managed to not nuke my system.
All right, I think my little one is up. I'm going to have to go.
Okay, have a nice one.
Wait a minute.
Have a good one.
We're not far off from me having to do the same thing because I have to go make dinner, but I can hang around a little bit longer.
Yeah, I probably should go and eat something too.
This was not bad for a first run at doing this, of just having some people show up. So I my intent is to do this every day, is kind of jump on and at least be here if people want to chat.
The quarantine diaries.
Essentially, yeah. I'm just, I hate, my job is social. Like, I'm always talking to people, talking to kids, doing, you know, that's just who I am, to where if I'm stuck in a house for going on 3 days, which is where we're at right now, I just need social interaction. So it's helpful for me.
Yeah, I've been using HPR a lot for that.
Thankfully, Matrix has been pretty much on fire. So that's been good conversations to be had.
Oh, yes. All right, I think I'm going to head out and have some, I don't know, noodles or something.
Sounds good, man.
Nice talking to you, Taj.
Same. See you around.
See ya.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.